This interview is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. In Practice is an independent publisher, and all opinions expressed by guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of In Practice.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the In Practice podcast. We'll be discussing Danaher today. Will, when did you first come across Danaher?
I don't even know actually. Well, put it this way, too late. or maybe that's not even the right way to put it. It's like,
that is the right answer. That is the right answer.
I was too stupid, basically. Yeah, it's the right answer, but I came across it, but like, did I really come across it? Yeah.
No, clearly, the right answer
clearly
would have
I
been,
didn't.
right answer would have been you came across it a very long time ago.
Well, I did, but I didn't really know what I was looking at.
And of course you didn't. I mean, we're looking maybe what, 10 years ago that you first set sights on the business? Something like that?
Well, I mean, look, anyone who studies investing or looks at these businesses wants to deploy capital into companies and compound them for a very long time, you're going to come across Danaher at some point, right? I probably came across it probably longer than 10 years ago. And I've always been interested in looking at kind of niche industrial businesses, which obviously Danaher very much started, well, not starting, but kind of evolved into over the last 20 years. But I think it's one of these businesses where, I mean, I came across it, and I think it's probably a similar story to like Constellation Software. You come across it and it's got, you know, it's got a great track record, but I just didn't really fully internalize how unique the business was or is. And, you know, probably I'm a slow learner, so it takes a while for me to fully understand and have conviction in any business, frankly. But I think what I found fascinating with it is just how it's evolved over, it's had various different lives over, you know, 40 years since the 80s. Yeah, so I came across it probably 12 years ago, and followed it loosely. But over the last 5-6 years, I've studied it a bit more intensely and kind of finally got around to taking the plunge and looking at some of the more recent acquisitions it's made over the last 5 years in terms of bioprocessing and the shift to become a life sciences business effectively today. And then we're also studying in parallel to that is how this is possible. How can a company shift from, you know, over time from an industrial acquisition platform in the 80s and early, you know, 70s, 80s to becoming pretty much a leader in, you know, providing life sciences equipment, and eventually who knows what this will become over time, right? So I think that's what, if you look at what's pretty interesting, is that this company obviously has a philosophy or a framework to operate businesses, you know, in what they call their DBS, Danaher Business System. And so I've spent years trying to understand exactly how this works, how can it be applied in both tangible, heavy companies like industrials or manufacturing businesses, and also then in, call it more, you know, much higher gross margin or more intangible businesses and their own life sciences products and consumables and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I kind of been loosely following and still loosely, you know, still following it, at least more intensely now, and frankly, still trying to understand it, to be honest.
Well, we're going to talk about how you have been going about trying to understand how this business creates value and how it's evolving and what that means as you try to understand what it's worth or how to value the business. But quickly, let's talk about how you think about opportunity cost of where you spend your time. You are running the IP research first party business. You have two full-time investment analysts reporting to you, very soon a third. Let's articulate, for the benefit of, I think, many of our existing subscribers that might not be familiar with this, and any new subscribers, just how you think about allocating your time, in what category Danaher fits as part of our large and then mid-cap coverage. We've got a couple of broad coverage areas. We would put this in the large cap coverage bucket. What does that even, you know, let's talk about what that means and how we think about that. In the way we spend our time?
I don't really think about it as like large and small cap necessarily. You know, I think it's more about why is this business durable? Why can Danaher continue to print 20%+ free cash flow margins for the next 10, 15 years? And that kind of gets to the point of, you know, and obviously Danaher has many different types of businesses under one roof. But really, it's I think the opportunity cost question is very good, because I think about this a lot, and not spending time on businesses that I can't study for 5 to 10 years, because it takes me a while to understand them, right? And having that, building that longevity into the process, or having the opportunity to benefit from that. You don't only want to compound the capital, you want to also compound your knowledge in the industry. And you have to have the business has to exist, or the industry has to be attractive for you to want to compound in that industry. And so choosing the right business, but also the right kind of market is really critical. And I think with this one, it's, you know, it's that regulatory lock-in that I look for in many different businesses, and whether it's, you know, TransDigm and the aerospace aftermarket, which we've done a lot of work in, which is effectively underpinned by FAA regulations in manufacturing parts for commercial aircraft or military platforms. It's the same with Danaher, in that, well, specifically in its bioprocessing business or division, you know, it's that FDA requirement and regulatory framework that requires you to be heavily, you know, compliant in how you produce equipment and consumables to customers. And so that's really where it stems from. Like, in my mind, that's the opportunity cost. Like, the opportunity cost is, if for whatever reason, firstly, that regulatory moat doesn't exist for a very long time, call it less, like the durability of the return on invested capital. Like, how long is the regulatory lock-in going to last for Cytiva and Danaher? And then secondly is like the runway. Like, how much, what's the organic growth of this industry? What's the, how is this going to last 10, 15, 20 years that is going to be attractive to study for, but also potentially to invest capital into? So I guess it comes back to just, you know, the kind of simple math of like the return on invested capital and the reinvestment rate or the organic growth rate. And so, like, that's what really underpins how I choose where to spend. That could be like the same with, you know, Fever-Tree is another one that I've studied for a very long time that I think potentially has a long runway. Potentially, you know, this much smaller business, potentially a durable brand and interesting brand equity, and potentially a long runway. But, you know, ultimately, it's still an implicit judgment on whether that's true or not. It still takes time to kind of understand that. But I think ultimately, yeah, that's how I think about opportunity cost. Like, how can I allocate my time towards industries and businesses that have a durable return on invested capital, and also the reinvestment runway to deploy that capital or that free cash flow? I think that's what's attracted me to these holding companies as well. You know, the TransDigm, Danaher, Constellation, the Nordic guys, because they really focus on that kind of simple math, right? Of, can you build the infrastructure of a company that can make sure you manage and protect that return on invested capital, i.e. the underlying profitability of your businesses you own, and then redeploy that capital, you know, wisely and for a very long period of time, right? And so I think Danaher have obviously arguably up there, you know, with Berkshire, is like one of the pioneers of this, and they've done it in probably the most unique way, which is have gone from buying what people would have suggested were somewhat commoditized industrial businesses, you know, manufacturing companies, to now owning potentially the future of biologic manufacturing, cell and gene therapy assets, which is kind of still blows my mind, and I still don't truly understand it, you know. But it's, and that, you know, and so there's kind of back to the question of opportunity cost. Like, I think about this a lot, and how can I work with our analysts to make sure that we're all spending time on these, on areas, and, you know, companies, markets, industries that have those dynamics that are particularly attractive. So aerospace aftermarket, you know, VMS, vertical market software. We have the holding companies type that fits, they can be at various different forms, which overlaps with like Constellation and Danaher. And then there's, you know, the auto aftermarket, which also has kind of similar attributes in a way, less regulatory lock-in, but the kind of similar runway. And so we kind of take that approach to, you know, you can also take it to various other industries like luxury market. Well, you know, why is that interesting? Well, you know, luxury stood the test of time for thousands of years, right, in different shapes and forms. So I think it's that opportunity cost is embedded in how we look at our implicit judgment or assumptions about what we think is the potential durability and redeployment rate of a company.
So let's go one layer deeper and look at, so on our site, we've got this coverage map. We somewhat arbitrarily, I mean, there's a large cap and a mid cap section. As you've just explained, we actually internally don't so much think about that categorization. It's just a, you know, an efficient way to represent things on some level. There's a wide range of businesses. Many of these businesses we have studied for a decade or more. Most of them at least 5 years. You've got everything from Markel to Netflix to CCC and Fevertree. When you think about what to do when, speak a little bit about that. Danaher, on your radar for 10 years. We've been publishing since we founded IP 5 years ago. Actually, one of our most viewed interviews is an interview we published four years ago on DBS, on the Danaher Business System. So what is it about, lay out and articulate for the benefit of our community here, your process for prioritizing a given company at a given point in time, right? There are around 80 companies on the site that we have listed as core to IP's first party research coverage. How do you filter that on a month to month basis in terms of what you're working on?
Well, it's marginally more professional than a monkey throwing a dart at the board. It's largely stems from the quality of the executives we can source, right? And I mean, that's ultimately how whatever's published on the platform, the foundation comes from great executives. So we're not going to do work or interviews unless we find great people in that space. When and how we choose our team to go and find companies, executives on those companies is a good question. And it's really, to be honest, there's no million-dollar question of like idea generation. If I could source these ideas regularly, like, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here. So I think it's mainly, obviously, I follow these companies fairly closely. So if there's a problem in the business or the equity trades fairly cheaply based on historical measures, or there's a sudden issue in the business that makes it particularly interesting, that would flag on my radar. You know, so it's a mix of how attractive is this from an investment standpoint today, which is, you know, one of the big questions. And then secondly, do we have the executives to help me understand what drives the investment thesis on each business? And whether that's mid cap or large cap, you know, I don't really kind of look at it that way, but I would typically have a kind of a rough list of businesses that I think are, you know, particularly interesting from an investment standpoint that would be pushed up higher on the list. And that kind of depends on how the market is and the company trades, the earnings, all that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, it's like I said, it's not perfect, but it really, it's based on how attractive it is right now, plus the executive sourced. For companies like Danaher and companies that I've studied for a very long time, I'm kind of always working with our team to submit new projects on new angles consistently. And say, for example, with Danaher now, it's, you know, we focused on a very specific part of Danaher, right? Of like the biotechnology part, which is mainly, you know, the bioprocessing assets that they have, the manufacture of the biologic. They also have diagnostic products. They also have cell and gene therapy businesses. So the moat and the free cash flow that's generated from the bioprocessing business as being redeployed into these cell and gene therapy companies like Aldevron and IDT and other assets over time. And so that's the next part of the process, right? So, you know, we spent some time on bioprocessing. Now we're going to look at effectively where this free cash flow is being deployed, which is mainly in cell and gene therapy solutions. So I don't know if there's any magical way to kind of predict what I'm going to cover. I have a sense, at least over the next few months each time, but it chops and changes. For example, CCC came on my radar, and you know, I've studied Copart and the auto insurers for a while, and finally got around to look at CCC, which, you know, the stock hasn't done much since it was listed, and it's got effectively a forced seller in the prior PE owner that listed the business. And so there's potentially interesting dynamic there where you're going to have people that want to sell their equity in CCC regardless of how it's performing over the next 18 months. And there's another one, for example, Just Eat Takeaway, which I've looked at for on and off for years and, you know, never kind of got comfortable with it. You know, that's also, they recently sold Grubhub, which has been a kind of thorn in the side of Just Eat. And so I've circled back on Just Eat, and we'll look at that business for the next, for, you know, next week as well. So it's obviously quite unpredictable, but it's a function of really what's attractive in terms of from an investment standpoint. Plus, are there research angles that can actually help me? Because other stuff, like, sometimes you can do as much work as you want, but it's not going to help.
Well, this is it, and I think hopefully for our audience, what comes across is just an evergreen fieldwork process. We're a research-first organization. We've got a handful of businesses that have a track record of compounding where we're trying to figure out what the next 10 years might look like. Then we've got a category of businesses that we put in the emerging compounder category or potential compounder category where we think there's some element or some aspect of quality in the nature of the moat, the quality of the management team, et cetera. And we'll try to uncover whether quality is actually there.
And just on that evergreen point, like, it's only evergreen if the businesses are evergreen. Like, you know, you have to survive to be able to study the company. And I think that's part of that opportunity cost question. It's like, are we studying businesses that we think are durable? Let's start there, right? And I think just recently with my work on Fever Tree, like, I'm kind of amazed at how much I continually learn about certain industries. Like, and maybe I just didn't understand how you distribute FMCG products anywhere near as I thought I did, which is probably, you know, definitely true. But there is so much nuance in all industries and businesses. If you want, and I'm not saying that you have to know every single detail, like, about every company. Of course you don't. And someone would argue that if you feel like you need to know all those in details, then it's not a good investment opportunity, which is also true. But yeah, you know, I've done 3 interviews couple of weeks ago on Fever Tree. Probably spent, I don't know, 20, 30 hours looking at Fever Tree last week. And the layers of nuance in distributing products on-premise and off-premise, I learned so much last week. And, you know, I'm sure I'll just continue to learn more and more, even if I still do, you know. And obviously, we interviewed the right people. They were great people. But I think the point is, the compounding of the research process can be very powerful. And if I think about the times that I thought I'd done, you know, 3 or 4 or 5, even 6, 7 calls within a short space of time on an industry and thought I kind of knew really how it worked, you know, I've done 50, you know, plus 60, 70 calls on Fever Tree probably over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and still learning the real nuances of, you know, selling a product to Kroger or selling to Walmart, or, you know, how it works in different states. And so I think it's the power of compounding the knowledge is, you know, just a reminder when you do this work on the same company for a very long period of time. And to do that, you need businesses that are evergreen.
So let's look at Danaher now and how we move from this business is interesting. It looks like it's going to be interesting for a while. Now's an interesting time in its history, whether there's a valuation layer to that or element to that, or just the business is undergoing some major transformation. And it's interesting for that reason that the evolution of the business might require a bit of work to get up to speed on. How do you go from that, or how do we go from that to, one, there's a couple things that we think matter, that we care about investigating, that we think are worthwhile? And two, how do we, or which of those areas that we think are interesting, that we think are relevant to long-term shareholders of this business, how do we move from that to what can we fruitfully investigate through field work? Which is ultimately, yeah, I mean, we're investors and we're studying companies and we're researching companies. We're also a research business. We publish everything we work on, and there's an effort on our part to publish on areas that are fruitfully or can be fruitfully investigated through field work. Because there, I will say that we see a lot of work being done by investors who are probing in areas where field work is really ultimately not necessarily that useful, or where there isn't that much potential. So how do you avoid that pitfall?
Danaher is a fairly good example in this case, because over the last few years, say post-COVID, the main challenge with Sartorius and Danaher has been the level of inventory in the industry. And I guess it depends where you are and how much you understand Danaher. That's a whole different question of how much you really think you understand bioprocessing if you're sitting behind a desk and not actually a chemist, right, or a biochemist. But most investors, if they assume or if they do really know Danaher, they would focus on a destocking. So they would go and do channel checks, right? How much inventory have they hold in? When are they looking to buy? How much are they looking to buy? And they would try and understand when, you know, Danaher and Sartorius are going to start growing organically again based on the overall kind of organic growth trend of biologics. Now, at IP, we could do some kind of channel check product. We could go and interview, 20, 30 different customers, gather the data, do a mini survey type product, gather the information. But it's also kind of not what we're focused on. And partly what we've done is we've started at like the first principles. Regardless of the destocking issue, which is more like a 2-3 year cycle investment thesis, which by the way is fine if that's the way you invest. Why are we assuming that bioprocessing is sticky? It's specced into the FDA process. They can't rip it out. It's got higher switching costs. Let's truly understand exactly why that is the case. If you can deploy capital for 10, 15, 10 years and at scale, then, for me, that I want to understand exactly how sticky are these products. And also like the product life cycle, and they're sticky, but are there new products that are going to come in that are going to be much better, that every new installed plant or manufacturing line will have the new product? So firstly, for us, it was back to this question of why I'm even looking at Danaher, this assumption or potential regulatory moat the company has of when you buy Cytiva, chromatography resins and equipment, you pretty much cannot swap them out. It's very, very difficult. And therefore you have pricing power and effectively a moat built around being specified into the manufacturing plant. And Danaher sells many other products than just chromatography resins and skids. They sell various filtration products, filters that go across upstream and downstream, various different use cases of the filters, various different lock-ins, various different competition as well per filter. So for me, at least to understand Danaher and the durability of the business, at least I'm talking about Danaher in the sense of this bioprocessing segment, for me to understand the durability, I only want to understand exactly how it's specced in, right? How deep is that regulatory? So if you look at the research we've done, it was really just starting there. Like I didn't even look at anything to do with destocking or inventory levels or something that would be fairly shorter term, which many investors, if they owned Danaher or looked at Danaher, would probably be looking at that and would probably be trying to forecast Danaher's revenue in the next quarter or the next two quarters to see when the stock is going to bounce back, right? We were approaching this over understanding the business for the next 10 years. And so what we done, which I think was pretty interesting, was went back and actually tried to understand exactly what these assets are. Because you talk about Danaher and bioprocessing, these actual products and assets are made up of products that were acquired from businesses 20, 30 years ago. So we went back to GE's filings when Danaher bought GE Healthcare, life sciences business. And then we went back and looked at Danaher when they bought Amersham, which is UK business. and went back and when Amersham bought Pharmacia, right, which is the original kind of chromatography product, was owned, the intellectual property was owned by Pharmacia, a Swedish business. We went back and dug in through the old Amersham filings, looked at the old product lines, and then found an old Pharmacia guy who worked for Pharmacia, worked at Amersham, and worked at GE, and spent a bit of time with Danaher when they acquired the asset. And to be honest, the work that we done on Danaher was pretty much was built off the foundations of conversation with two or three guys, mainly two people. And one of them was in the business for 30 odd years and was originally there at Pharmacia and evolved in selling both filtration products and chromatography products. And so it wasn't, again, at a high level, it's not too complicated, right? And just going back to first principles, what is this business? What is the, if you want to look at the regulatory mode, find great people and have those conversations about why this business is durable. And that kind of, that built the foundations of the learning journey, which is structured in a way to kind of walk through what we think are the most important points, which are, how are these products specified into a manufacturing line, i.e. how sticky are they? You know, why are they sole source? Why are they not dual source? And what might change that? You know, and what is the product life cycle? Why have chromatography resins, you know, Cytiva's Acta resins, why have they lasted 20, 30 years with 80% market share? So questions like that, we really probe at rather than focusing on destocking stuff that others might.
I want to talk about, so as we bring today's chat on our methods and on Danaher to a close, I want to chat about how you structured the learning journey in particular and why you made the choices you made. With a view of helping our subscribers and anyone else interested in IP and this business, with a view of shining a light on how we think, right? So you've got, so this, I'm speaking specifically, whether you have an IP account or not, you go on the Danaher Biotechnology, Cytiva and Downstream Bioprocessing piece published on October 8th. At the top right, there is an article index. We start with Cytiva's history. Right, we then go into a whole series of headers that organize the work that we've just been talking about for the last half hour. Will, tell us about some of the choices you think are important when you're curating work like this.
It's a good question. A lot of it is kind of unconscious. Trying to get me to explain my unconscious. I mean, the first part, like the Cytiva history, should be obviously self-explanatory. I tend to do this with every business I look at. Like, I just go back to the essence of it. And actually, this one particularly is interesting because, as I just said, there's three different lives of these assets, four different lives of these assets before they become owned by Danaher. So you had Paul, which was owned by the filtration portfolio, mainly owned by GE before, and then obviously we mentioned GE, Amersham, Pharmacia for the chromatography business. And so it was nothing more complicated than just going back and looking at where the essence of these businesses come from. And what's particularly interesting is that specifically for the Pharmacia business, these assets have been generating 30% plus ROEs for decades. This is not just a business that's got to scale and, you know, started printing free cash flow. Like, these have been highly profitable, high market share assets for a very long time. That just gave me my research question there and then, right? Like, why? How is this possible? There's not many other businesses that I know, Google search maybe, like it has 80-90% market share for 20 plus years. So, you know, that was the obvious starting point. And then the next part is really, I mean, these learning journeys, the way I think about them is, it's a curation of the research process, but the aim is to serve both people who want to get up to speed on the name or the business quite quickly, that therefore have, you know, maybe have read the filings and know roughly the company, see it's interesting, but I want to actually learn about Danaher from the bioprocessing business from scratch, and also interesting for someone who owns Danaher and knows the business. And that's what's very tricky about doing these, is I try and write them so they have two people in mind. So you can write in a way that people can get up to speed on this company or actually get into it to learn about it when they might not know much about bioprocessing. But also it should add value to someone who really does know this business and industry well. And that duality is actually, maybe I'm just fooling myself here that it's possible, but I try and write it in that way so that both types of investors can get value. Whether that happens or not, I'm not sure, but that's the aim. And so, but really it's designed around, so the history part is where I start with everything. Then it's designed around what I think really matters about the durability of this business, i.e. that question. Why are core parts of Cytiva had such high market share for 20 plus years at the ROEs that we're talking about here, 30%+? And therefore, it's organized in a way which is, okay, firstly, let's look at the history. Secondly, let's just level set and make sure, okay, what is the bioprocessing? What's the biologic manufacturing process? So what are the various different steps in that, just so we're all clear on what we're actually talking about here? Right? There's various different stages of upstream, downstream filtration, chromatography, and various other filtration methods. Then you get to the point of like the FDA approval process and how these products are specified into the manufacturing line, and which kind of is critical to the moat, right? And the stickiness and therefore the pricing power of these businesses. So just going through that, and then obviously there's two parts of this business. There's chromatography and filtration mainly of Cytiva. So we split those up separately, looked at each of the durability, the stickiness, the moat, and the product lifetime or life cycle, which is an important part, which I've tended to focus on much more over the last 18 months, which is how often do these products evolve, which may increase disruption. And I prefer products that don't change a lot and are therefore are locked in, i.e. aerospace aftermarket is a great example, because once they're FAA approved, it's quite hard to change them. And to be honest, bioprocessing equipment is probably quite close to that. And they have very similar characteristics. So it's really organized in that way. And then the idea is the last part, it rounds off, and a big part of the thesis potentially of why Danaher have bought these businesses. So they've bought Pearl Filtration, they bought the Amersham and Pharmacia chromatography businesses. They put it under one roof, under a new brand called Cytiva. And they're potentially, although they might not say this, but they're looking to potentially bundle filters and chromatography resins, mainly because the filtration side of the business isn't as competitive, or arguably the technology isn't as unique as the chromatography resins. And so it kind of rounds off to potentially a core part of the long-term thesis here, which is, are these businesses specified in for long periods of time? What are the switching costs? And or how are they better together under one roof? And that pretty much gives you like a breakdown of that learning journey that hopefully makes sense to people, not just me.
Well, for those that are interested in where the next 10-20K of our spend in terms of our fieldwork budget is going on this business, on this space, we've listed a number of further research questions, which we will do on any learning journey and at the end of any IP research piece. So you're aware of where we're headed next and what questions we're asking. We always welcome feedback. Thanks for listening today, everyone. We appreciate it.
As always, this is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for investment decisions. Please do your own research.